Hey, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good to see you all back. You can always get a first class. If people don't come back the second time, then you start to worry. So it's interesting. Hanukkah, most people don't think about it as being a kosher holiday. But actually, the holiday started when there was a Jew who was invited to eat from an offering of pork. And Matisyahu just couldn't believe that. He just couldn't, you know, it's one thing if a person wants to do what they want to do, but to publicly take the pork and eat the sacrifice in front of everybody, he just couldn't fathom it. And that's what his feeling, his strength and his desire for kosher really got him going, and that's what gave him the impetus to be willing to go and fight the war. It wasn't an easy decision to go out and live in the caves and to fight against the Greeks, but it was the final straw was when the kashrus was violated. The truth is, there's another lesson in Hanukkah that is interesting, and that is that Hanukkah is all about giving thanks. That's the major theme of the holiday is lahodos u'hallel, to give praise and to give thanks. And there we go. Okay. And in the prayer we give thanks and we say Al Nisim for the miracles and the wonders, and then we give thanks for the wars, Al Milchamos. Why would you give thanks for war? There's nothing good about war.
Unless you win.
Unless you win. Well, okay, that's true. That's true. But why would we be grateful for the war? What is good about a war? And one of the answers given is that a war brings out certain focus and certain passion that was missing. And we have a tradition that before the miracle of Hanukkah, that the Jewish people were missing a certain passion about their religion, that things had gotten very blasé. It says the Kohen Gadol changed his name to Jason and was absent from the temple and was in the gym and doing some of the Greek stuff. And people were forgetting their heritage, and they slowly were giving it up. And Hanukkah was a relighting or a reuniting of the passion. And so it was necessary to have a war to invigorate us and to show that we were... Is there a door we can close?
Yeah.
And Hashem, or God, took away our temple from us because the Kohanim didn't show that it was important to them and that it mattered to them. And then along came the Maccabees, and they showed that it was important, and it did matter, and then Hashem gave it back to us. And so it was a response to a sin or a fault of ours that we reinvigorated ourselves, and we rededicated the temple. One of the ideas of kashering is that basically in the way in which something becomes non-kosher, that's how you need to make it kosher. In other words, depending on how much it got contaminated, that's how far you have to go to uncontaminate it. And that was really the theme of Hanukkah, that we had taken the temple for granted, we had taken the service for granted, we had taken our religion for granted, and we needed to go and show that it did matter to us. And then, what do we mean? Kashering comes up. If you're not kosher, if your house isn't kosher and you want to make it kosher, you have to kosher your things. And then if you have things that are kosher for year-round and you want to make them kosher for Passover, then you also have to kosher your things. But really, in every kosher house, you should have a special drawer where you keep things that by accident become non-kosher. In other words, it's just bound to happen. If you have children, it happens all the time. We've just blamed it on the children, but or a husband or whatever. That things will, by mistake, you use a milk knife with a meat, you know, or meat with the milk, or you wash it wrong, or you buy the wrong product, or something splatters, right? And so things will become non-kosher. It's by mistake, it's not a sin, it's nothing wrong, but then you want to re-kosher it so that you can use it. So then the question is, well, how bad is it? Right? In other words, so the first scenario is I have a meat pot and I'm taking it off to serve and it starts burning my hands and so I quickly put it down. Whoops, wrong counter. Anything happen? My wife's going to kill me? What did I do, right? So, first of all, if everything is cold, if two things are dry, meaning the pot is dry and the counter is dry, then there's no contamination. So even though the pot is hot, if it got put down on the wrong counter, no problem. Just pick it up, put it back. In other words, in order for you to have a problem, you would have to put a meat pot down on something wet, or there'd have to be some kind of spillage. But if you just put down a meat pot on a dry counter, or vice versa, there's no contamination. And similarly, let's say, in theory, if you have a meat pot and a dairy pot, and they clank each other somehow, bang, you know, as long as there's no, there's nothing wet in between, it's just dry. So not, when two things are dry, there's no way for the meat, you know, any kind of meat flavor to be imparted into the dairy, and so no harm done. We don't recommend putting meat pots on dairy counters or dairy pots on meat counters, but if everything was dry, it's no harm done. And that always happens. You put a coffee mug down, whoops, it's coffee, it has cream in it, it has milk in it, I put it on the meat side, but as long as nothing spills, there's not going to be an issue. Because in order for there to be a problem, there has to be a liquid. There has to be a moisture, or there has to, but again, if you just put it down on the wrong cap, just pick it up and put it back, no problem. So that's one good thing to know. Now, if something became non-kosher through, let's say something cold spilled on something. In other words, let's say milk spilled onto a meat counter or a meat spoon, or it's cold milk. Sometimes it happens in the fridge where milk spills and it drips on the out. So basically, if it's just something cold that spilled, you can just wipe it off and clean it off. If the exposure is just something cold, let's say milk drips onto a meat counter or onto a meat pot, onto a meat dish, and there's no heat involved, so all you're worried about is the external milk or the external meat that spills, so you can just wipe it off. It's a cold contamination. Okay? Let's say, for example, somebody serves something dairy on a meat plate. They get a dairy cake, and they didn't realize it had butter in it, whatever, and they serve it on one of your meat plates. So this cake is cold. It's not warm. It's not hot. And so, therefore, it's not going to, even though it's dairy, it's not going to contaminate or ruin that meat plate. Okay. Now, there is one exception. There's always an exception, and that's if a liquid sits in something for 24 hours. In other words, if you had, let's say, milk sitting in a meat cup for 24 hours, then you could be in trouble. Because when something sits in something for 24 hours and it's a liquid, it begins to get absorbed. But if somebody just, another example, somebody takes a meat cup, let's say from your China set, your nice Shabbos meat set, and they take a drink of milk out of that meat cup. So again, a rule was when something is cold, it does not get absorbed. So all you have to do is rinse it out, rinse the milk out, and your cup is fine. If it was left in the cup for 24 hours, then you'll be in trouble. At least kosher-wise, and then we can talk about how to kosher it. So, again, if there's a contamination between two dry things, there's no liquid, or there's no, it's just put down on the wrong counter or the wrong place, there's no koshering needed, there's no cross-contamination. There needs to be a medium of liquid. Number two, if the contamination is through something cold, it can just be wiped off, and then it doesn't get absorbed. Okay. Now, what happens, though, if it was something hot? So, for example, somebody is serving meat, and by mistake, somebody puts a milk fork into the meat. Right? And this fork is dairy. It wasn't supposed to be used with the meat. So, our number one first question the rabbi is going to ask, what does the meat have?
What is hot?
Oh, well, that's a good question. What is hot? Well, usually what we like to use is the word that if you were to touch it, you would pull your hand back. In other words, if you were to touch it, or if you were trying to eat it, it would be hot so that you would pull back, or you wouldn't be sure that you could taste it. It's still smoking. But if it was to the point where it was just warm, so again, if it's just warm, you take that dairy fork and you could just clean it off, and it's fine. Now, if it's hot, and let's say it may have been hot enough to contaminate it, so then this fork was a dairy fork that was used with meat, put it in the drawer for kashering, and on a rainy day, you can kasher it. Now, oh, that's a good question. Now, could you eat the meat? So, if it was cold, then no problem, because the dairy fork was cold and it was clean, and the only way the dairy could go into the meat would be if there was a medium of heat. So if it was just cold and into the meat, it would be no problem. What about if the meat was hot and then you stuck the dairy fork in? So we have a concern, and that is that the dairy fork has dairy. There's two problems here. One is that the dairy fork may have dairy absorbed in it, and if the dairy goes into the meat, that's milk and meat. That's no good. That's not kosher. And then the other problem is the dairy fork absorbs meat. And it's dairy. And you can't have a dairy fork that has a flavor of meat in it. So those are the two problems. So I mentioned that no problem. As far as the dairy fork absorbing meat, just put it in your drawer and you'll recapture it. And we'll explain how you do that in a minute. But your question is a good question. Well, what do we do with the dairy dish or the meat dish? There's an interesting rule that sometimes will save the day, and that is if the fork, what was our case, the dairy fork and a meat dish? Okay. If the dairy fork was not used for hot dairy within 24 hours, so there's not a strong enough dairy flavor in that fork to make the meat non-kosher. In other words, you would have had to have used that fork for a dairy dish that day, or within 24 hours, and then stuffed it in the meat, so we say that since it was just used in a cheese dish, it just was used for breakfast with hot dairy, so it absorbed dairy, and we'd be afraid that dairy that was absorbed went right into the meat. Uh-oh, we got problems, we got milk and meat. But if that dairy fork was not used within 24 hours for hot dairy, so it didn't absorb, it may have absorbed a while ago, but whatever it absorbed after 24 hours is not very strong. The flavor is dissipated, and so therefore the meat would be no problem.
Are these modern laws, or did they know better? Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, the amount of time, hot versus cold, and the transfer?
They've held up to modern science for the most part. I would say in all ways. In some ways, they're stricter than science. If you, for example, we're concerned that glass absorbs the flavor. Actually, there's a difference of opinion about it. The Sfardim, they say that glass does not absorb. And you'll find Sfardim that use glass for milk and meat. And that's no problem. Our custom, the European Jewry, Ashkenazi Jewry, is we don't use glass for milk and meat. Dishes and stuff. We would have separate, not talking about drinking glass, I'm talking about like dishes. So, because we're concerned that the glass absorbs the meat flavor and glass absorbs the dairy flavor.
Can you actually measure that?
Can you measure how much it absorbs? So it's interesting. So scientists, they claim, you know, in the lab, the glass is porous. They make test tubes out of glass. But it's a hard question. We have, I'll tell you an interesting thing, that we have a rule that a lot of companies use a steam system to heat up their boilers. And what they do is, down in the basement of the company, they have a big steamer with boiling water, and they shoot this boiling water through the pipes of the company, and that heats up the water in the different boilers that are in the different facilities in the building. So we have a concern that sometimes you have a building that has on one side a kosher restaurant, and on the other side a non-kosher restaurant, and it has the same steam through the same system. Okay? So the problem is this steam goes and heats up a kettle of pork chops, and then it goes on the other side and heats up matzo balls. So every time we do this, it never fails. The scientists and the people that are in charge of the steamer, they say, oh no, the flavor doesn't go from one side to, it doesn't go through the steam line. That's what they will always tell you. It doesn't go. So we have there's kind of a trick. Not a trick, but we can neutralize a food by putting chemicals in it, by putting a cleaning chemical in it. So we say to them, all right, let's put a cleaning chemical in the boiler. We have food, you know, we have chemicals that are legally allowed to be put in a boiler system, and they will say, well, we can't do that because then it'll make the food taste like soap. But a second ago they said to us that no taste transferred from one side to the other, but then they won't let us put boiler chemicals in because they insist it does transfer. Does it or doesn't it? I don't know. But again, we are, so in certain ways we're stricter than the, you know, science, less the Spartan actually, they do use the glass for the milk and the meat. But overall the concepts were scientific concepts. In other words, they dealt with, so for example, if you cook fish in a pot, and then you, an hour later you're going to cook another dish, it'll taste like the fish, because it gets absorbed, the flavor does get absorbed into the pot. Yeah, good question.
I have a question. If you bake a pie, our pie, and you serve it, you know, at a meat meal, and you cut the pie to serve it with meat knife, even though the ingredients and the dish and all are carbs, then if it's kept cold later on, can you cut another piece tomorrow, or the next day, with a beer knife and put icing on it and serve it on the pie?
That's a good question. If it was not brought to the table, things that are brought to the table that are served at a table, like when you bring a loaf of bread to the table, so we're always concerned that in the middle of the meal, somebody might have used a knife that wasn't so clean or may have taken another piece. People like to take another piece when you're not looking, you know, they just cut up a little, you know, and so we're always concerned that things that are at the table could have been contaminated or, but if it wasn't brought to the table and this equipment was clean, then you could very use it the next day.
That would be the same with a loaf of bread.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Correct, that's right.
I've always been like overly cautious, so I'm like curious about, you know, what these little people.
It's certainly, if a person had like a bread knife, that certainly makes it a little easier because then it's only used for bread, so, But then it's also sometimes difficult to, sometimes you assume something is clean, but it's not always uniform. Like sometimes the machine didn't work the way it was expected, or it just didn't get cleaned as much. Okay. So we're talking about occasionally these things happen, and they need to be recaptured. So the most common way of recapturing is with boiling water, which sterilizing, you know, that's the common method that I use for cleaning things is to use boiling water. And that works very well for most of the time silverware. It can always be recaptured by dipping it in boiling water. There would be a three-part process. One is the item has to be cleaned. So, for example, if you use the dairy fork in meat, so first you have to clean off the meat off the dairy fork. We would wait 24 hours before we recapture. And then we would have a pot of boiling water, and we would dip the spoon in the pot of boiling water. As long as the water is boiling, then that fork would again be kosher. Now, the question you would ask is, do I use a dairy pot or do I use a meat pot? Because this is it used to be dairy, now it's got meat, now I need to re-kosher. So, which pot do I dip it in? So the truth is, you can use any pot. You could use a dairy or a meat pot in theory. We would try to use a pot that hadn't been used within 24 for anything that day, for 24 hours. Because in theory, if a pot isn't used in one way or another in 24 hours, it doesn't have a flavor or something. And so you run less of a risk of contaminating what you would be kashering. Yeah.
When I find a kosher for using European chips, Poles. When he used to put lots in the bowl.
Okay. There's a reason for it.
So
there's a few things that happen in kashering. when you do a lot of silverware at a time, so the metal is cold, and so when you drop it in the pot, you lose the boil if you've done a few pieces of silverware. So rocks are a trick. They keep the water boiling. They keep the heat. That's one thing. Looking for rocks. Okay. And then there's another thing, and that is if you want to kasher a pot, and then you need the water to overflow, and so you would use a rock to do that sometimes to get the... But that's pots are a little bit more complex. Most things can be re-kashered. The most complex thing to kasher is china. Many times the heat, it's worth asking your rabbi if you have an issue with the china, because sometimes the heat isn't enough to cause a problem. There are other issues as well that that are worth looking into. One thing that people aren't aware of is that we would kasher plastic. And in other words, if you have a plastic utensil that became non-kosher, it could be kashered. 20 years ago, we didn't kasher plastic. And that was because when you put the plastic in the boiling water, it would melt. And so what people would do is they dip it very quickly, or it was very hard to really know that you did it well, because you're supposed to leave it in the water for a few seconds. Today, they make the plastics better. So you can put it in the boiling water, it won't get ruined. So if you have an old book, it'll say, no, don't kasher plastic. But the newer plastics are actually much stronger, and they'll hold up to the boiling water typically, and you'll have no problem in kashering.
You've got a knife with a wooden handle.
So you can kasher metal, and you can kasher wood. The only time you have a problem is sometimes you have a knife with a wooden handle, and there's a crack in between. And so when you kasher with boiling water, the boiling water hits the entire surface of the knife and the handle. But if there's a crack in between, the water won't get inside the crack. Now, some knives, there's no crack. They make it flush with the handle. And so if you look at the knife and the handle, you don't see a space. So those you can kasher with boiling water. But if there's a space in between the wood and the blade, like a crack, then it's very difficult to kasher, because there's no way to get in that crack other than hitting it with like a blowtorch. And if you use a blowtorch on wood, it'll get scorched a little bit. But if there is no crack in between, then it'll be no problem with a knife with a handle. Okay. Moving along. The kashrus is more, kashering things is more complicated than that, but I just wanted to mention just a few things. Now I want to go on a little bit, and let's talk about fish. Let's talk about fish. So, fish, in certain ways, is easier than other things, because there's no shechita. You don't have to shecht a fish. A fish doesn't have to be killed in any special way to be kosher. The vast majority of fish are kosher. As long as it has fins and scales, it's a kosher fish. And almost, other than things like shellfish, which I don't think they really are, I think they're not in the fish family, if they you know, the, what?
Crustaceans,
yeah. Real fish, almost all fish have fins and scales that would be kosher by nature, and you can buy fish really anywhere, as long as you know it's a kosher fish. So then you come to the question, well, how do I know it's a kosher fish? So the problem is, once you take off the fins and scales, they all look alike. So if the fish is already filleted before you get there, so you can't, it looks alike. And actually what's happened in the sushi market is it's relatively common for them to switch less expensive fish for more expensive fish. And they say, oh yes, this is the finest, you know, whatever it is, but it's really a much cheaper imitation. And they've even gone so far to use coloring. They use coloring to make certain fish look like other fish. They learned how to do that. But the halakha basically says that you know something is a kosher fish if you see scales on it. So, now, the question is, can you rely on the package? What if the package says that it's a kosher fish? So we did not rely on that. The fact that the package says it's a salmon or it's a carp or it's a... If you can identify it as that fish, then we would say it's fine. But we don't rely on the, just because the one that's selling it claims it is that fish. There's no, it's relatively common that, especially in fish, that they have mix-ups. One of the things you'll notice on all the kosher tunas, they're always dolphin-free. And the reason why is because the non-kosher tuna, they just throw the dolphin in. You know, when they catch these big schools of fish, they just throw it through the grinder. And so all the, you know, whatever they catch for that school, sometimes they catch a dolphin, and the dolphin goes through the grinder and ends up in the tuna fish. Whereas in the kosher tuna fish, they have a system to weed out the dolphins. And so once they're doing it for kosher, they might as well brag about it. So everybody, I don't know, people are more sympathetic to dolphins than they are tuna fish. I don't know why. They're all creatures of Hashem, but it's because you go to SeaWorld and you see the dolphin, so you don't want to eat it. But the tuna fish, it's okay. But Charlie the tuna. But if you want to eat a kosher fish, you need to see that it has scales. One interesting, I saw a commentary that said the reason that the kosher fish has scales are it means that they can go upstream and they can go against the tide. See, if a fish doesn't have scales, it can't. It just goes with the flow. And a person has to be able to go against the, you know, the kosher fish means that you got to be able to go, even if the tide's going this way, you got to go the way that's right. And so the fish has to have scales on it. Now, as long as you see one scale, it's a kosher fish. You don't need to see all the scales. So it's an interesting thing. Many times on tilapia, they'll leave one scale on, and they'll cut off all the rest. And that's how they do it in the kosher, if you've ever heard, like, there's a kosher tilapia that comes from South America, and you wonder, hey, they missed a piece. But actually, that's how the rabbi that certified it didn't have to be in the factory. See, if he would have been in the factory, then they could have cut off all the scales. He wasn't in the factory, but the way they did it was they leave a tiny little scale on, and every single piece of fish in that batch has a tiny little scale. And they did this in China, and they found that the Chinese were gluing a scale on. That's why we're careful what we eat from China. You've got to be careful with what. But as long as it has the scale on, it's fine. Sometimes they leave a side that has the skin on, and you can see where the scales are. Certain things are, you really need somebody that knows fish to show you. Because like certain things, like the big tuna, it doesn't look like a scale. It doesn't look like the scales that we're used to seeing, but if you see it in a certain way, you'll see how it is. If you look up close, you'll see the scales. But you can go to any store. You can buy it from anywhere. If it has a scale on it, it's a kosher fish. Now, there's another problem, though. And that is, what about the knife? Even though the fish is kosher, what if they use their non-kosher knife and they cut a lobster and then they cut a shrimp and then they cut my kosher fish? So that is a problem. One way around the problem is you could buy a whole fish. If you buy a whole fish, it's no problem. You just have, you have to take it home and cut it yourself. But a whole fish is no problem. Now, there really isn't such a thing as a whole fish because before you get it, they gut it. Because they don't want to have all that junk that's in the gut when you get to the store. So they always cut the bottom of the fish. They cut out the belly before you get it. So is that a problem? No, that's no problem at all, because the place where we get the meat on the fish from is not from the gut. There's no part that we eat that's right on the gut. So even if you bought a whole fish and it's already cut on the gut, that's no problem. And some fish, they cut the head off. That's also no problem, because there's no meat that you're going to take straight from that part of it. In other words, the concern would be that where that knife touched, that knife had like an oil on it from the non-kosher fish, and that oil went into the top layer where they cut. So, and that is true, that the area where the non-kosher knife touched probably went into that spot, but on the gut there's no meat there, and also on the head there's no meat there. That we take from. So even that wouldn't concern us. Where it would concern us, though, is if their knife touched the part of the fish that we're planning on eating and taking and serving our family. So then what do you do? So lest you wonder, are these knives really dirty? Just go into any of your favorite fish market and ask them to look at a clean knife. And very carefully, these knives are very sharp, run a napkin along the bottom of the knife. There's like a film, an oily film that stays on these knives. It's a fish oil. That's why they want us to, you know, it's a very healthy thing because it stays in your system, very strong oil, fish oil. But they knives, and so that oil stays there from one fish to another, and you're concerned that they use it for non-kosher fish to a kosher fish. So what can you do? One thing you could do is bring your own knife. In other words, you come into the fish store, you see the fish has scales, you see it's a kosher fish, and you bring in your own knife, and you say, do you mind using my knife? The guy says, why not? And he could put down a piece of paper and cut the fish in front of you, and there you have a kosher fish. And guess what? You're your own mashkia. You're hired. you can work for the AK. In other words, you've supervised that fish cutting, and that's fine. There's no problem. You brought your own knife. They put down paper, that you saw them take a kosher fish, and this way you didn't have to bring it home and get the mess and everything, and they cleaned it out, and that's fine. Some places don't like you bringing sharp knives into their stores. Before 9/11, it was a little easier.
Well, you're having a place issue and you have the cultivation report, as an advertiser.
Uh-huh.
And the question was, you have to remove the plate and the utensils that you're using with the fish, I'm asking, not telling you, from the table before you serve the meat.
Let's get to that, okay? I just want to finish the fish subject. They don't want to let you, they don't want to use your knife. And their knives are much sharper than your knife. So then what? So, again, the ideal thing is if you have, you know, you can go to a kosher fish market and they pre-cut it. There really isn't a lot of that in Atlanta. There's some places, Kroger, Publix, other places do a little bit of kosher fish cutting. But it's not always the fish that you want. It's not always the variety you want. It's just, in larger communities, they have all kosher fish stores that are just have kosher fish. You can go in whenever you want. We don't have that yet in Atlanta. So sometimes you have to look for a solution. So there is one solution, which would be if you can ask them to sanitize their knife, ask them to wash it with the soap and the chemicals. And some of the farmers markets actually have like a machine to sanitize the knife, like a special knife washing machine. And then you can inspect it when they're done to see if it has that film, you know, if it feels oily. And if it's clean, the knife is clean on the surface, cold and clean, and they put down paper, and you see it has scales, it's good. And they are, if they're not busy, sometimes they are very accommodating or they're willing to do that. And that would be a way to do it. Let's say they don't want to do it, they're busy, they don't need your business, is there any solution? So again, the major concern is to make sure it's a kosher fish. So you saw that it was scales, but they used their knife. So what can I do? So there's two, maybe three views. The most lenient view would be you could take it home and scrub that fish and scrub off their oil. In other words, they use their grinding knife, and you took it home and you did a called shikshuk. Great word in Hebrew. Shikshuk. You know, you scrub that knife. There's another view that says that you got to scrape the area where the knife touched. You know, you give it like a, you know, like the barber does, you know, scrape it a little bit. And then the strictest view would be to just cut away a very thin layer where the knife touched. But again, it's all kosher, and, you know, any of those views are acceptable depending on maybe where you bought it, how clean the knife was, what your concern would be. But sometimes that's what you're presented with. The fish was already cut, it's home, somebody brought it. Now, actually, the frozen fish in this regard are better than the fresh, because in the frozen, in the factories, they do hundreds at a time. And they're less likely to go back and forth the way they do in the supermarket. In the supermarket, one customer wants this one customer wants. And so there they do go, whereas in the factory, some people feel it's less of a concern. Some people would even just do the... So on frozen fish, many people, as long as it has scales, they'll just do the shikshuk, they'll just wash it well. Whereas if they went to the supermarket, then they do the more scraping and the... But all of these are legitimate. They're all fine. The person's welcome to ask their rabbi if they have a concern. But these would all be ways to have kosher fish. Okay. Any questions? Yes? Any soap that works for this purpose. Because at the end, as long as they rinse off the soap, as long as the surface area is clean, that'd be fine. You asked an interesting question. Does soap need to be kosher? That's really what your question is. So the truth is they could use non-kosher animal fats in soap. And occasionally they do. And it's better, even if they do use non-kosher animal fats in soap, today they don't make any soap purely out of animal fat. They add other ingredients. And those other ingredients would actually neutralize the non-kosher ingredients. So from a practical point of view, if soap was used that did not have a hechsher, it would be fine. Some people feel that you don't even have to worry about the hechsher because the other ingredients neutralize the possibility of the non-kosher animal fat today, because it's not that common in regular soap to have animal fat. So there is an opinion that says that soap does not need to have a hechsher. There's another opinion that says, and this is what most people follow, that if it's readily available with the hechsher, then you should buy it only with the hechsher. But if you can't find it with the hechsher, then you can follow the lenient view. And that's typically what we would recommend. In other words, if you go shopping and you can find one that has OU, and you can be sure it has, so why take a chance? You know, that on the other hand, if you're somewhere and you need to have a soap and the one they have does not have any hechsher, so then you could follow the lenient view and use the one that does not have the hechsher. Interesting enough, this question comes up with Brillo. Brillo has a non-kosher ingredient in it. The Brillo soap pad. And that's years ago it was kosher, and then they switched. And so it would be more ideal if they have the Rokea, or you can use a different Scotch-Brite or whatever that has the... but if you do use it, it's okay. There is a lenient view that says that the other chemicals neutralize the non-kosher, and it's fine. You know, there's no leading and strict. We all choose which areas we want to be leading and strict. As long as you're allowed to follow, in other words, as long as the lenient view is legitimate, meaning that there are there's a basis for it. There's no problem doing so. Yeah.
I have a question about fungi. You're talking about Brillo.
Okay.
Three sponges? Mm-hmm. Dairy, harp, and meat? Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, so three. Is that just...
Right. Pretty much. Some people won't have a car and will just wash it in the air. You know, it's sometimes hard to have a real car. Not everybody has car. Some people just have meat or dairy or the. But yeah, in theory, you need to have three sponges.
If you have something like a car dish, could you wash that with either a dairy or a meat sponge? Or do you, I guess it's my question, do you need a
If it was washed with a meat or dairy sponge, it would still be parv. It really depends on how likely it is that the sponge still would have, you know, particles of one thing or another. So in theory, if it was... See, there's a lot of things that depend on how the kitchen is cast and who is the last one to use it. So if the sponge could be dirty, could have particles of meat still on it, then you wouldn't want to use it for par for the... So from a practical standpoint, it's better to have a par of sponge. Okay. So, moving right along. So we've talked about fish. Now we'll get to fish and meat. Okay, because we talked about a little bit about milk and meat. And we talked that... So fish and meat, fish is kosher and meat is kosher, and fish and meat are kosher. We have a custom going back over 1,000 years not to eat fish and meat together. And we're very proud of our customs and our traditions, and we're the only ancient people that's around today. In other words, there are no other people that have been following the same religion and the same path. All the ancient civilizations are gone. The Hittites and the Jebusites, and even the recent civilization, the Romans. It's hard to find a communist today. I mean, it's just so. If our grandmothers and there is a tradition in the Talmud that a certain kind of fish, together with a certain kind of meat, is not healthy. And over time, we don't know exactly which kind of fish and which kind of meat. But since that time, and we're not clear, we avoid having meat and fish together. They're both kosher, and therefore you can serve meat on a dish and you can serve fish on the same equipment, but we avoid serving them directly together. Because it's during the Middle Ages, during the Black Death, they noticed that the Jews weren't dying in the same way as the Gentiles were. And they were convinced that we were poisoning the wells. But really, it was because we have rules about washing our hands before we eat, and washing the food, and keeping certain things separate, and burying the dead right away. It was really just because these laws have made us who we are. And it's the ability to follow through and to keep to the laws that have made us disciplined and a holy people. And so we certainly would encourage keeping the tradition of not eating meat and fish together, even though we don't know today why which fish and which meat really are harmful to us. But if, you know, we've been around for 2,200 years or whatever, and we're still kicking, then, you know, it's good enough to keep it's the longest diet that's going. Now, what do you have to do to separate between eating meat and fish? So the custom is you don't want to eat meat and fish directly together, either on the same plate, but you can eat one after the other. Everybody's been to the smorgasbord where they have the chopped liver and they have the lox and they have the... So there's also an interesting Jewish custom that goes back hundreds of years, and that is to wash, you have to rinse out your mouth with a drink in between meat and fish, and you try to also eat something solid. You know, so there's a mitzvah to have, maybe a rugelach or something else in between the meat and the fish. But the custom is to take a l'chaim after the fish, because you want to make, you know, you want to clean out your mouth well, and you want to sit. So that's in many households right after the fish. That's when they bring out the schnapps. That's the and they're cleaning their mouth out in between the fish and the meat or the. But really, you can use water or soda or whatever. But on the Shabbos table, that's very common. That after the fish dish, people will bring out the liquor, they drink the l'chaim, and that's it. Now, can you use the same grill for meat and fish? So in theory, if you clean the grill in between, you could. Certain grills are harder to get clean. Again, that oily film. certain things, if you look at them, there's just a grime that's left, and so you really don't want to have any meat grime left. But if you're confident that you got it clean, sometimes you let it burn a little longer, and that burns off anything that's there, so then you could use the same grill for meat and fish. Not at the same time, but you could have, you know, now you do meat, now you do fish, and that would be no problem. Now, what about dairy and fish? So, we do eat dairy and fish together. There is one group that has a custom not to eat dairy and fish. Small group, but you may run into, I forgot which country it is where they don't eat dairy and fish together. I don't remember which, is it Moroccan or someone, Sephardic? I don't remember exactly who it is, but it's not a mainstream. 95% of the people eat dairy and fish together.
That's
excellent.
So it's really about just the grapes. It's not about whatever fumes might have been on.
Correct. With fish and meat.
Usually we leave that on anyway afterwards, so anything would have burned off between one
yes.
and the other.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. But then that fish can only be served and meat bites.
It depends on if there's any kind of steam, or like if there were a piece of meat that fell into the grill first and then sometimes when you grill, if you grill meat, little pieces fall through and it creates a steam. But if you did the fish first, then it could, in theory, be totally part. Talked about meat and fish. Okay. There's something I was going to say, but I forgot. Okay. And, Tabasco sauce. So, there's some steak sauces, some Tabasco sauces that... Worcestershire sauce, that's the one I was thinking. Thank you. I knew I was forgetting the name. Worcestershire sauce that has anchovies in it. And it's a favorite for recipes for meat. So what are you going to do if you're kosher and you want to use a good Worcestershire sauce? So actually, many people don't notice this. Right next to the kosher symbol on Worcestershire sauce, if it has fish in it, it'll say OU fish. And that means that you really shouldn't use it on meat. But they have some Worcestershire sauces that just say plain OU, which means they're kosher. You can use them on meat. Because either they don't have fish, or the amount of fish is so small that it's nullified. It wouldn't contaminate the meat. So as long as it doesn't say, oh, you fish, you're okay. Now, there's a real surprise in the orange juice section. They have a heart-healthy orange juice that has an oh, you fish on it, because it has fish oil in the orange juice. And so in theory, you shouldn't drink that orange juice with meat. But if you wonder why it says fish next to the OU, that's why it says OU a fish. Now, this comes to a general rule that a kosher symbol, if it's just a kosher symbol, it's par. If it's the kosher symbol in a D, it's dairy. If it's a kosher, if it has meat in it, it should say the kosher symbol, and typically it would say OU meat, to be consistent, unless it's obvious that it's meat. But if it's just a plain OU, it should just be par. But if it has meat or fish or dairy, it should say so on the label. Okay. Moving along. There are some things that are not kosher because they're holy. And one example of that would be challah. Now, most people think that challah, we didn't talk about this last week, did we? Most people think that challah is the Jewish bread that we eat on Shabbos, which is true, we call that challah. But in the Torah, when the Torah talks about challah, what makes challah holy is that it's a piece of bread that before we eat, we share it with someone else. We before we take our own bread, we separate a piece for Hashem. And we think of others. And that piece that we separate in the dough is called challah. Now, you only have to do this if you have more than 2 pounds of flour. If it's a tiny amount of flour, there's no mitzvah to separate challah.
The recipe, when it says take challah, it means that.
Yes, that's what it means.
Okay.
So, when you have more than 2 pounds, I think it's two, I have the exact measure, it's like 10 cups. I hope to bring it next week. I mentioned that I'm going to bring you some things in writing. Yeah.
What if it's already made dough? Do you have to separate the...
Yes. Actually, if it's already made, you can still separate challah. And our custom is not to do it like there's a place in New England where there's a bakery, which is, there's a sign up, separate your own challah. Like you go in and you take off the piece, and because they don't do it for you, but you have to... on all the matzah boxes, it always says the challah has been separated. So you're thinking, challah, matzah, what's going on? Matzah is not challah. It means the biblical piece that's separated. So in previous times, we would give that to the Kohen. That's how we would support the scholars and the priests, that they would get that special piece that would be separated. Today, we're unable to give it to the Kohanim because... It had to be eaten with a sanctity, with a holiness. Because when a person shares their bread with somebody, that's a great mitzvah. And so it has to be eaten in a purity. And we don't have that purity today, for the most part. It requires the red heifer and the going to the mikvah. So we're unable to do that. And as a reminder that we're missing something in our daily life, we burn that piece. And that piece is called challah. And what typically people do is they wrap it in foil, and they put it in the back of the oven and they let it burn. But in the ideal world, we should be able to give that to others and to help the poor. But we're reminded that we're living in an imperfect world. We have a lot of, it's like on the wedding when we break the glass. We need to be reminded that we have a lot of work to do. We need to fix the world a little more. But that piece of dough should not be mixed with the rest of the food because it's holy. It has a certain holiness to it, and so we always wrap it in foil so it doesn't contaminate anything else. But if you were to like take that piece after you separate it and throw it in with the rest or touch it on a plate or something, there could be questions. But there, that piece of challah is holy. And now, if there's only 2 pounds, you don't make a bracha. You need about 4.5 pounds to make a bracha on challah. Again, I'll bring it in next week, and you can find it on the internet. They have exact measures: how many pounds of flour do you? How many don't you? When is the person obligated, or when does the person have that mitzvah to take challah? Men have the mitzvah to take challah also, but it's the wife's prerogative. In other words, we have men that come to us and say, "Well, in the house, my wife doesn't let me have that mitzvah. Can I go to the pizza shop and take a piece?" And pizza shop is happy to let you. They use challah dough by the tons. And so, if, in theory, every man should want to do, or every woman should want to do, every mitzvah at some time in their life, just to have the flavor of it. So, if you want to, you know, you can take challah, you know, you can do that mitzvah, which is a very significant and special special mitzvah. If you bought dough that's already made, you don't have to take challah. So if you buy the dough that's already, like, pre-made dough balls, there's no mitzvah to separate challah on that. It's only if you make the dough that you would do that. So here, it's the challah itself, though, is like non-kosher in a sense that we don't want it to, it's holy, and we don't want it to touch the other things. Produce from Israel is holy, and it's not that it's non-kosher, but we're not supposed to eat it until we've done the proper blessings and separatings and sanctifications. It's very similar to challah. So if you see like an orange, there's a special prayer that you say. So until you say that prayer, you really shouldn't use the produce from Israel. Now if it has a kosher symbol, that means that they took care of it. And in the Israeli market, they have little signs up that they took care of it already, that the rabbi took the piece. But if you buy a Jaffa orange or something, there's a prayer in the siddur to say to make it kosher. Now, it's not that it's not kosher, it's kosher, but it's holy, and we don't mix holy and not holy, and so something that's extra holy, in theory, could be forbidden for us to eat until we take off a piece and we separate it and we do the right thing. One kind of interesting thing that came up is that last year in Israel was a sabbatical year, and the food that grows in the sabbatical year is considered holy, extra holy. And there's some wines that are on the market that are sabbatical wine. And one of the rules about things that grow from the sabbatical year is that you're not allowed to waste it. And so if you use this wine, you're not allowed to spill any out. And so so first of all, you can't use this for Havdalah, because on Havdalah we always have our cup spilled because our cup runs over and you'd be wasting that wine. And then also you have a problem that sometimes you serve guests wine and they don't like the wine, they leave it there. And so what you'd have to do with sabbatical wine is you'd have to go and collect it all and either find someone to drink it or find a respectful way to there's not a lot of it out there, but if you notice that it's sabbatical, it's kosher. You can't say it's not, it's just holy. It has a separate rule. One other thing that's kosher, and that is if somebody didn't toivel something. What is tefillah? There's a mitzvah from the Torah to when something is purchased, a new equipment is purchased, when it goes from non-holy to holy, we sanctify, we baptize it, we take it to the mikvah. And that's, the Torah mentions that when we fought the battle against the Midianites, there were a whole bunch of vessels that were conquered. Before we could use them, it says that they had to be brought back to their source, so to speak, and they were baptized or they were dipped into a natural source of water, which is the mikvah. Now, some places you don't have a mikvah, you can go to the ocean or go to a natural stream or a lake, or and then some places have a mikvah, which is, they finished the mikvah here, they got enough rain? Anybody know? What? They're almost there. But anyway, so they're, now what happens if somebody bought something and they forgot to take it to the mikvah, or if you're eating at someone's house where the food is kosher but it wasn't taken to the mikvah? So the food is still kosher even if it was made in something that's not toiveled. On the other hand, you do have a mitzvah to, you're not supposed to use something that's not toiveled. So for example, if you realize that they have it in a pan that wasn't toiveled, what you do is you then put it on a paper plate or something that was already toiveled, and then you'd have no problem. But you're not allowed to use something, or you're losing a mitzvah if you use something without sanctifying it. And that's the idea. Before we take something for ourselves, we sanctify it. We make it holy. In life, there are a lot of things we do, but we try to elevate what we do. And that's the mitzvah of mikvah, taking things and making them holy. Well, there's more to say on the subject, and we'll probably take that up next week. I just wanted to mention, next week is going to be a shorter class, because there's some kind of program that evening, some Torah and science or something, and I know a lot of people wanted to attend both. So, what? Oh, Big Bang, okay. So what we'll do is we'll try to finish the basic program in time for people to go to that class, and then afterwards I'll stay a little longer for questions if you're not attending that class, and hopefully we'll be able to cover some any subjects that weren't covered.